It is 8:30, and we have with us in the studios once again John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
How are you both doing?
Well, good. Finally, after 2 weeks, I've shaken this freaking cold. That was the fourth one, and I was hoping winter was over, but maybe after the snow yesterday.
Maybe that's where your cold went.
That's true. Maybe it just got blown down into Oregon with the rest of the Arctic chill. But anyway, doing
right.
Well.
Well, had David D on at 7:30 talking about the FCC, one of our favorite organizations.
Yeah, I had a splendid time yesterday at the Federal Communications Commission hearings. Thanks to all the people who came out and testified and attended the public hearing and gave the three Republican commissioner appointees out of the five total who were not present. They did not come out to Seattle. What for? They'll probably have the videotapes waved at them. I kind of doubt they'll actually watch them, but it's possible. The question, of course, media consolidation and relaxation of ownership rules, actually abolition of most of the limits on radio and television broadcast property ownership. And that was going to be rammed through by Michael Powell, FCC chairman, Cullen's son, until public opposition kept cropping up and kept increasing. They weren't going to have any public hearings at all. Then they scheduled one in Virginia and 100 miles away from D.C., and they were forced to do two more. One of them was in Seattle yesterday, a huge turnout, another big event at EMP last night. And, all you can say is keep those cards and letters coming to the FCC and also to the Telecommunications Committee people in the Senate and the House of Representatives, because they control the FCC's purse strings. If there is pressure from Congress, that can help force the FCC to back down and help preserve what little is left of diversity in our public airwaves.
And also to our different local media outlets and explain things to, like letters to the editor, explain to the rest of the people out there, since the papers aren't doing such a good job, what's really going on here.
Yeah, although Frank Buffen actually is becoming the champion of independent media, which I think he genuinely does believe.
That was a jaw-dropper.
Well, no, he sees himself. I mean, the Buffen family has barely majority ownership in the Times, and it's one of the last major newspapers anywhere in the country. Actually, we're one of the only major cities left that has two daily newspapers. And the Bluthen family is one of the only ownership interests in any of those newspapers that is not a large chain. Bluthen owns the papers in Portland, Maine, and here, and some smaller ones in Maine. But he sees himself as competing like against groups like Knight Ridder and Gannett and Hearst, and Hearst owns the PI, and they're very concerned that Hearst will come in and buy 8 or 10 radio stations in Seattle and be able to sell that jointly with their PI advertising. So he has direct financial interest in not seeing the FCC act.
All right. Well, looks.
Oh, and I did want to say, by the way, mm-hmm. for people who want to support independent media, and we've run into a tremendous number of people who've said they enjoy this program. Thank you very much. Get other people to listen to this program, and not just this segment, but all of Mind Over Matters on mm-hmm. Saturday and Sunday morning.
And sometimes you can tape it and give a copy to your friends of a program you really liked and get them hooked on it, too.
Yeah. And for people who listen in other cities, because there have been other stations in different parts of the country who pick this up, too.
We're not against people bootlegging.
No,
Where are these programs posted on the Internet, Mike?
Both. Well, they're posted at KXP for 2 weeks, and then some of the stuff is posted at the radioforall.net website.
Yeah. And that's radio and the digit 4... and then the word all.net.
.net.
Or KEXP.org.
For 2 weeks. They keep them fresh. And yeah, thanks for all the people that in their comments mentioned Mind Over Matters. That was pretty cool because, that goes into official records. So anyway.
It means we'll all be investigated soon, I'm sure, if we're not already.
And there goes another couple of red flags. So let's move along. Seattle City Light.
Yeah,
a little change this week.
Yeah, we thought we'd do an experiment this week and see if we could not mention Iraq for a few minutes. We'll probably hold out for about 5 more minutes. Mr. Zarker, the breathtakingly incompetent head of City Light, who has managed to mismanage the publicly owned utility to the point where all of our light bills have gone up dramatically over the last year or two, when they did not need to go up nearly so dramatically. Independent auditors and independent Commission blamed his leadership, actually, for much of that mismanagement. The city council has been after his hide for the last several months. And yesterday, just ahead of the votes that would have fired him, Zarker resigned to a blistering attack by Greg Nichols on the city council for pestering what he claimed was the brilliant management and brilliant administration of an administrator who will be, truly be missed by all citizens of Seattle.
Zarker is Nichols' personal friend.
Yeah, and political ally as well. And it really points up a couple of fairly troubling dynamics about local municipal politics as we head into the season where people are starting to lay groundwork for fall city council elections, which aren't getting a lot of attention this year because of all the international events going on. One is that there is this tremendous split that has developed between Greg Nichols, the mayor, and the city council. A lot of real genuine personal animosity on both sides. And Nichols is demonstrating loyalty toward people he considers either his personal friends or his political allies, that really demonstrates a blindness toward the actual job performance of those people. It really raises the question of what you have to do if you have an ally in City Hall to get fired in Seattle city government, because there are several other examples as well of people who have really badly mismanaged departments that, you know, essentially have lifetime sinecures because they have friends in high places. So, you know, it's a reminder, and we don't want to spend too much time on it because we've got a lot more to go through, that, you know, keep paying attention to local politics and keep demanding accountability and start paying some attention to some people who can run for city council this year who can displace some of the folks on city council who are Greg Nichols' allies.
Like Margaret Pagler,
particularly.
Who bragged up Zarker's performance.
Yeah. Pagler had, she's seen public utilities as sort of her turf and her area of expertise on city council for a long time. She's the ranking member in city council in terms of seniority. And she saw this as a personal affront also, that the votes were there to force Zarker out. So so there's some questions about her integrity and you know, willingness to keep people on the carpet too.
In addition, Heidi Wills received a lot of emails and a lot of messages from people who were very upset about, I think it was like a 58% increase in energy bills this year because of City Light mismanagement. And they spewed to Heidi Wills, who I believe is the chair of the committee that oversees City Light. And she voted with Pagler to reconfirm Zarker, not to fire Zarker. So I think people need to be looking at her as well.
Yeah. Wills is the person who really hasn't stood for very much on city council other than her own fundraising and her own political fortunes. But because she is a very good fundraiser, it's been scaring off a lot of challengers, and a good challenger for her needs to be found and soon.
Because I had read somewhere that she was actually asking some harder questions about City Light.
She was, but I think it was to appease people, knowing that she was going to vote for his reconfirmation.
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of appeasing people, there was a big vote, not a vote. There was a big presentation yesterday at the UN, and with
yes,
the UN weapons inspectors.
And knew we couldn't stay off Iraq for too long.
No. Yes, I wanted to talk a little bit about the presentations made by the UN weapons inspectors chiefs, because I know that the rest of the U.S. media is not going to mention it at all. In fact, they are not covering much of what the UN inspectors say when it contradicts what the Bush administration wants to do in Iraq. They only cover it when they think it's going to support the Bush administration. And I just want to cover it because people need to know what the UN inspectors are doing and what they said in their reports to the UN Security Council.
And I want to talk a little bit more about the media in a minute, too.
Hans Blix made his report. Now, he's been in charge of the inspectors looking for chemical and biological weapons and looking at the missiles. His report was profoundly positive for Iraq. He stressed that Iraq is allowing surveillance flights over its territory now without demanding advance warning, that they have surrendered a list of people involved in destroying chemical and biological weapons, that Iraq has allowed private interviews. 7 have occurred in the last week without any Iraqi handlers there or taping of the conversations. Iraq has appointed a government commission to search for documentation on the destruction of chemical and biological weapons and for further data on those programs. They have destroyed 34 Al-Samud II missiles, including 4 training missiles, 2 combat warheads, 1 launcher, 5 engines, and 2 casting chambers used to make further missiles. And he called this, quote, a substantial measure of disarmament, indeed the first since the middle of the 1990s. So he was very, very positive about that development. He also stressed that they're helping, that Iraq is helping inspectors to excavate currently a disposal site that's unearthed 2 liquid-filled R-400 bombs. Those, are, I believe, are used as biological warheads, and 6 other complete bombs, as well as many, many bomb fragments, which may allow them to account for some of the missing chemical and biological weapons. Iraq has also located and surrendered documents on its VX and anthrax programs and has made a promise that next week it would issue a more up-to-date report on its anthrax and VX programs. Now, in addition, inspectors have also been able to search for the mobile bioweapons labs that Powell has made such
yes,
a big deal.
You remember those.
You remember those mobile bioweapons labs that have no way to treat toxic waste and don't seem to have any way to power them. the UN inspectors have been looking for
those.
That
look, well, maybe they are looking at their own trucks, since they look a lot like the UN trucks, as I recall, too.
Yeah. Some of those satellite photos look like they were photos of UN vehicles. But the UN inspectors have been looking for these mobile bioweapons labs, and they've inspected mobile food testing laboratories, mobile workshops, and large containers with seed processing equipment inside them. But Blix stressed that no evidence of bioweapons have been found so far. And he asked for much more information regarding these trucks. I'd also like to stress that because there are surveillance overflights over Iraqi territory now, without warning, that it should be fairly easy to see if weapons or weapons-making equipment, including equipment used to make these Al-Samud II missiles, are being moved around, as Colin Powell has said. And Blix made no mention of having seen any of that.
And he has access to the information from those overflights.
He has all the access to that information. Now, he ended his report with 2 key points. He said that UNMOVIC is moving forward. UNMOVIC is the weapons inspectors in Iraq. They're moving forward with drafting a program of work that will define a list of the remaining disarmament tasks, and that will hopefully stop this continuous round of unsubstantiated accusations from the U.S. and from Britain about various, you know, things that Iraq is doing to develop weapons of mass destruction that keeps setting the bar higher and higher for Iraq. So that list of the remaining disarmament tasks is setting up a goal for the U.N. to reach for Iraq to reach for, and that's something that the U.S. would like to avoid at all costs. But this is something that UNMOVIC is expected to come up with this month. And that Blix has said that definitely in his report. The other key point that he made is that he gave a rough timetable for the inspectors, and he consciously echoed Bush's quote about going to war in a matter of weeks, not months. And I just want to read this quote. Blix said, quote, "How much time would it take to resolve the key remaining disarmament tasks? While cooperation can and is to be immediate, disarmament and, at any rate, verification of it cannot be instant. Even with a proactive Iraqi attitude induced by continued outside pressure, it would still take some time to verify sites and items, analyze documents, interview relevant persons, and draw conclusions. It would take not years nor weeks, but months." So he's asking for months, not the weeks, not the 10 days that the Bush administration is giving him.
Yeah. Can I just talk a little bit more about that? Because that was part of my media thing. Yeah. There have been a number of media aspects of the run-up to all this that have been very troubling. And talk a little bit more about the language that has been used and the avoidance of coverage of things when they're troubling to the U.S. war effort as opposed to supportive of the U.S. war effort or anticipated to be supportive. And we've seen a number of areas in which essentially actually U.S. propaganda has not been challenged or has not been questioned. We saw that repeatedly with President Bush's press conference on Thursday night. And, you know, get into use of language. We don't really have time for that. But one of the things that was most troubling was this whole portrayal that the U.K. proposal for a March 17th deadline was some sort of a compromise proposal. It was not. It was a demand that the U.N. essentially, that Security Council ratify the use of force, because what they were saying was that Iraq had to complete its total disarmament by March 17th, that is to say 10 days away. The missiles that it is now destroying, it cannot possibly finish that in 10 days. It's physically impossible. So what Britain was asking the United Nations to do was to authorize the use of force, specifically by the United States, based on what we know now. You know, not on what would be known in 10 days, but because the bar that was set for 10 days cannot possibly be met in 10 days. That was not spelled out by almost any of the mainstream American media coverage of that. It was simply portrayed as, you know, this compromise effort that in transit it bridged, you know, Russia and France and China were rejecting out of hand, you know, impeding the U.S. effort to disarm Iraq. Well, Iraq's being disarmed. You know, the missiles are being destroyed. It's not impeding disarmament. It's happening. And the U.S. is what is trying to impede the disarmament process. Yeah. They're trying to invade Iraq instead.
Yeah, that March 17th deadline would end disarmament, and it would start a war.
Yeah.
Before you jump to El Barde's stuff, the one other thing I heard last night on when I was watching the speech was that he had also mentioned that if he could have his way, he would prefer twice as much intelligence coming in as opposed to twice as many inspectors on the ground.
So. Yes, that was a direct reference to the U.S. and British intelligence that U.N. weapons inspectors have said is largely garbage. That the information they've been getting from U.S. and British intelligence sources has not led them to any kind of evidence of weapons of mass destruction. And Blix is basically saying, if you got it, give us the information, guys. We would prefer to have that before we would prefer to have more inspectors on the ground.
And one of the other things that's been troubling about the media coverage is, you know, you have all of these indications that the U.S. effort to rationalize this war is all smoke and mirrors, and that much of it is blatantly dishonest at this point. A compilation of all the ways in which that is true is not appearing anywhere. And it could be put together relatively easily, but you know, there simply seems to be this extreme reluctance to challenge what most people in the public thinks is at best an adequate case in the American public, but apparently not in the media.
Obviously. So should I? I'll just move on and talk about El Barde. Before I talk about El Barde's report, I want to just mention also that the South African delegates, I think we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, that there were South African delegates in Iraq who had been responsible in South Africa for the dismantlement of South Africa's chemical and biological weapons programs. They went to Iraq to advise the Iraqi government and to check out how their disarmament procedures were working and how far along they were. Basically, and this was not reported anywhere as far as I could tell, except a few wire service articles. I didn't see it even in the British press. Basically, the South African delegates came back from their trip saying, Iraq has done everything they need to. As far as we're concerned, they're way further along than even we are. That South Africa still has some chemical and biological weapons information and capabilities that they think Iraq doesn't have. And so in their opinion, you think these guys would know, since they've already gone through the process and it's been deemed successful by U.S. sources, including Donald Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell and Paul Wolfowitz hold up South Africa as the example for Iraq. Well, South Africa says Iraq is further along than even they are.
Yes, and as we discussed last week, you know, the U.S. also had information that these weapons were destroyed in 1995.
That's right.
So, of course, they're farther along. They've been working at it for years. We just haven't heard that.
Yeah, and so now I'll get into what El Barde said. El Barde is the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is the U.N. inspectors looking for nuclear weapons capabilities in Iraq. his report was even more positive than Hans Blix, and he just basically reiterated what he said earlier. He said that over the past, and he started his report by saying that over the past 4 years in Iraq, industrial capacity, this is a direct quote, industrial capacity has deteriorated substantially due to the departure of the foreign support that was often present in the late 1980s. Now, that's a direct reference to U.S. support for Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs during the Iran-Iraq War. And what he's saying there is basically the U.S. was responsible for setting up the program, and since they're not there anymore, there's no way Iraq has been able to continue doing the kind of nuclear research that they wanted to. It's also a reminder that Iraq is a poor country. It's not a wealthy country, and that it's suffered under sanctions for 12 years. And has seen most of its skilled technicians emigrate to find better jobs and living conditions abroad. So he basically set the stage for, look, let's not think this is a really industrialized, well-developed country. They've got serious problems here. And so he went on to say that the IAEA, the atomic inspectors in Iraq, have been able to take weekly air particulate samples from Iraqi water sources. They've been able to take sediment and vegetation samples. They've even used a vehicle-borne radiation survey team that's covered some 2,000 kilometers over the past 3 weeks, and they've seen no evidence of radiation that would indicate a nuclear weapons program. They've conducted many, many interviews, including two completely private ones in the past week. He also called for other governments to allow the IAEA to interview former Iraqi scientists that are living in their countries. And that's a direct reference, I think, to access to U.S. intelligence on nuclear capabilities in Iraq, because the U.S. has been citing defectors as the sources for their information. He's basically saying, we want to interview some of those defectors. When are you going to let us have private interviews with them? So I thought that was very interesting. He also discussed three specific issues that were raised by the U.S. and Britain in the past couple of weeks since the last report. First, the aluminum tubes. He reiterated that the IAEA has seen design documents, procurement records, meeting minutes. They've taken samples of the tubes. They've looked at other data, and they've concluded that these tubes cannot be used for nuclear centrifuges, and that Iraq does not have the capability to adapt them. They simply are not able to. They don't have the equipment. They don't have the skilled technicians to do that. So he's saying basically the aluminum tubes are not for nuclear weapons production. Magnets, the U.S. said, well, Iraq has been trying to get a hold of heavy magnets. He basically said, that's bull. We've looked at all these magnets. They're not for use in nuclear centrifuges. Our experts say they can't be adapted for that use. And then finally, the attempts to acquire uranium from Africa. This is the most interesting one. El Baradei said that it was based upon documents that looked to have been fake or forged. So I find that very interesting.
And that was not reported anywhere.
Yeah, because those documents are from British intelligence sources. And basically he said, El Baradei said, we compared those documents to actual government documents from the country Niger, which is where they're supposed to be from, and they do not look the same at all. They look like they have been faked. So I thought that was very, very interesting. His conclusion was, I'll just read it very quickly, quote, after 3 months of intrusive inspections, we have to date found no evidence or plausible indication of the revival of a nuclear weapons program in Iraq. That's pretty, pretty definitive.
Yeah. And there was one other interesting variation, I thought, between what they were claiming and what the United States has been claiming. President Bush made a reference on Thursday night in response to some of these things with the interviews of Iraqi scientists by saying, well, they're not being interviewed freely after all because they're being forced to wear secret recording devices under their clothes, and because the hotel rooms in which they're interviewed are being monitored. They're being spied upon. Now, this was never contrasted at any point with the story that came out in the London Observer last weekend, which was basically poo-pooed by much of the media, except the Washington Post, which didn't report the original story but did report a later story saying that nobody cared, that the United States had, that the the Guardian Observer in Britain, and it had to be a British paper, obtained documents saying that the United States had ordered that countries in the United Nations delegation that were opposing war efforts, that monitoring, spying, in other words, be stepped up on those delegations, that the United States wanted to know their plans, they wanted to know what the strategies would be, that, in other words, the United States would be spying on and monitoring the hotel rooms of these particular delegations.
Now,
tapping their phones as well. Now, this is obviously a far more serious allegation than spying on the, you know, monitoring the hotel rooms where scientists are conducting interviews. In fact, it's relatively analogous to President Nixon ordering spying on political opponents during Watergate, and that and the cover-up of it led to its downfall. Yet, absolute media silence in this country around that.
All right, and finally, quickly, the talked a little bit about last week, I think, about the Iraqi opposition groups.
Oh, yes, and Monday was the end of a conference in northern Iraq of Iraqi opposition groups. They basically ended their conference calling for the U.S. to not allow Turkey to enter northern Iraq, and they called for the U.S. to allow Iraqi opposition groups and Iraqi representatives to rule the Iraqi people immediately after the war, not to allow a general, U.S. general, to take control of the country. Now, there are some other developments going on. The Iraqi opposition groups seem to be splintering and going their separate ways right now, and it's largely because of U.S. plans to allow Turkey to invade northern Iraq. The Kurds are very concerned about that. They've positioned more troops, Kurdish troops, in northern Iraq near the border with Turkey because they have said that they will fight a Turkish military invasion of Iraq. And Turkey is planning on sending about 40 to 50,000 troops south of the border as soon as the bombing begins.
Yeah, they're much more worried about Turkey than they are about Saddam Hussein
point. They very much are. In addition, the Shiites are also much more worried about a Turkish invasion of Iraq than they are. And they're even more worried now about a U.S. war against Iraq than they are about Saddam Hussein. And in fact, we saw this week both Iran, the nation of Iran, which borders on Iraq, and we saw Shiite opposition groups call for Iraqi opposition groups to reconcile with Saddam Hussein. I'm going to say that again, to reconcile with Saddam Hussein and call for elections in Iraq in order to avert a U.S. war. And Iran said that they view the U.S. as a greater enemy and a greater risk to international security and peace in the region than Saddam Hussein.
This is a man that they fought with for 10 years.
This is a country that they went to war with during the 1980s, where hundreds of thousands of Iranian troops and civilians were killed and were even gassed by Saddam Hussein and his forces. And yet they're calling for reconciliation with this man in a peaceful way to avert the war because they see the U.S. as a greater threat.
Well, and the U.S. has announced them as one of the, you know, axis of evil.
Yes, that's true.
And there you go. That's why.
I think it's funny that the British press is referring to France, Germany, and Russia and China as the axis of peace, which would mean that the U.S., Britain, and Spain is the axis of what? You can guess.
All right. Well, we are getting close to running out of time here, so
We should announce a few events that are coming up.
Yeah, there you go. Go for it.
On Sunday, there's going to be an International Women's Day Festival at the Seattle Center. I'm mentioning it because there will be a lot of peace groups there. It's linking international women's rights to an international peace movement, and I think that's a very good thing to do. I hope people go and check it out. It's from noon to 5 p.m. at the Seattle Center House tomorrow.
Oh, incident. There's also on the internet a new Code Pink effort that's underway. Starhawk and Susan Griffin and a number of other women and feminist leaders have issued basically a women's anti-war movement that's taking event over the web.
Yeah, and you may also find some information on that tomorrow if you go to the festival at the Center House, the Seattle Center.
All right, and then Tuesday night, a gentleman who I interviewed a couple of years back, Joseph Cerencioni, who is with the Carnegie Endowment for something or other. Anyway, he's a great speaker on weapons of mass destruction and he actually gets regularly quoted in a lot of the alternative press. But he's going to be in town speaking at Kane Hall 120 Tuesday night at 7 p.m. And the subject will be weapons of mass destruction and Iraq. So I'll be going. Yes.
And I just want to remind people that if you want to demonstrate against the war, that there are peace vigils and demonstrations going on pretty much daily around the Puget Sound region. If you want to find out where they are, you should visit Gene Buskin's activism calendar, which is at www.scn.org/activism/calendar.
With that, we are out of time. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchek, co-editors of Eat the State. And very quickly, tell people where they can find Eat the State.
It is a free publication, comes out every couple of weeks. We got a new issue coming out this Wednesday, another BAFO issue at places where you get free publications around town. Also available on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you can't figure out where on earth to find the darn thing, or if you'd like to volunteer, have story tips, feedback, whatever, donations, we always need those, give us a call. Area code 206-903-9461 is the voicemail.